And they forced me into this tiny little interrogation room off the big ante room, a whole mob of policemen shouting and screaming. And I thought I would perish there. I thought I was going to die there and then, which is exactly what they wanted me to think. Their intention was to overwhelm me with terror, and they did. But then Swanepoel's interrogation partner, a man named Richter, Harvey Richter, produced this brick. And he held it up in front of me and right across my eyes. And I thought, looking at its granular surface, that it would abrade my face when he hit me with it. But he didn't. He put it down in front of me and said, "Stand on it."
Welcome to the IPA podcast, Psychoanalysis on and off the couch. This podcast series introduces the many analysts around the world who, in addition to working in their consulting rooms on the couch, they also work outside their offices. They take their psychoanalytic skills and they bring them to many other venues. They bring them to hospitals, to refugee centers, to business leaders, to childcare clinics, to prisons, just to name a sampling of the many conversations we've had. We've also spoken with analysts again around the world about how they and their patients have been struggling with the COVID crisis. And finally, we speak to a group of analysts who meet the criteria, shall we say, of being the elders of our field. They have been practicing analysis for 40 and 50 years and have special perspectives on this particular period of history and an overview on what the field has been like and how it's evolved over the past half century. I hope you find these conversations engaging and thought-provoking. Please feel free to write comments at our website, ipaoffthecouch.org, and thank you for listening. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my guest today is John Schlepperborsky. John is a training analyst at the Institute of Group Analysis in London, and he's a certified group psychotherapist. Our conversation today revolves around John's history, as represented in his recently published memoir. The memoir is called When They Came For Me, The Hidden Diary of an Apartheid Prisoner. John describes in this memoir his family history before he was arrested at the age of 21 and subject to torture. And he describes in detail what that was like, not in an off-putting way, not in an exhibitionistic way, but in a way to let you know what his experience was and how one survives that. And he teaches us about how he survived it. He survived it by forming a relationship with the brick that he was forced to stand on. I won't say more about that now. We discuss it in the interview. He evokes the positive objects in us, as we all would in such circumstances. It includes his girlfriend, his family, his colleagues. He has a strong Jewish identity, which sustained him. And song, you will hear about his relationship to Simon and Garfunkel songs. And from there, we follow his life journey. He left South Africa, finally freed, allowed to go to Israel, where he spent 6 months, and then he settled in the UK, where he formed a life. He became first a teacher, then a psychotherapist, and a major person in the world of psychotherapy. He contributed a book in 2016, an important book, called From the Couch to the Circle, Group Analytic Psychotherapy in Practice. And as I say, his new book was just released this year. It is a moving conversation. It's a man who, if one can say, grows from such terrible misfortune. He certainly would be a person who one could say that about. I found it to be a delicate privilege to get to know him and to speak with him. And as detailed as our conversation is, the book is more so, and I really recommend it. In terms of his credentials, they are, as you might imagine, they're considerable. He has lectured around the world, Australia, China, Denmark, Japan, Sweden, the U.S., Israel, Germany, etc. He was formerly a consultant for the Traumatic Stress Clinic in London and the Medical Foundation for Victims of Torture, which is now a clinic called Freedom from Torture, which one could quite comfortably contribute towards if one wanted to support these efforts. He also has a private practice in London. It is a pleasure to meet him. I learned such a great deal, not only about him, but about life in South Africa during this time. I hope you find this as moving and important as I do. Here's my conversation with John Schlepoborski. John, welcome to the podcast. So glad to have you here.
Thank you, Javi.
John, you've written a memoir, a powerful memoir. It's called When They Came for Me, The Hidden Diary of an Apartheid Prisoner. And a key aspect of this memoir of yours is a detailed description of your, at the age of 21, at your arrest, incarceration in mostly solitary confinement, and your torture experience at the hands of the South African police. It's a deeply moving and profound recounting, such that when I had the opportunity to first speak with you, and this is not our first speaking, I was hesitant. And I wasn't quite sure why I was hesitant. I had never knowingly spoken with someone who had been tortured as you have. And I anticipated some awkwardness, some fragility on your part, as if you were, as a result of it, somewhat precious. And I felt ill at ease. And I wondered whether this was a unique experience of mine or whether others feel that way towards you as well. And if so, what a burden it must be for you to be treated sort of like a delicate piece of porcelain. And then in reading further in your epilogue, I found the description that captured why I was unsettled. And you write, quote, referring to the description of others who had been tortured, you write, "There are the darkest events in the course of human conduct to which, as witnesses, the only appropriate response can be the silence of respect or the indignation of tears," close quote. And that was what I was struggling with. The only appropriate response is silence or indignation. And you put me at ease in our conversation, and here we are, and off we go. Your memoir is more than just a recounting of your torture experience. It's a personal history before and after, and it's also a history of South Africa at this apartheid time. You were arrested in 1969. And I'd like us to talk about both the before and the after, about your family life and your political life. And then when you were released, and you were released under very unusual circumstances, you were allowed to go straight from your prison to Israel, where you spent 6 months. And then from there, you went to the UK, where you settled and made a life for yourself. And you've told me that your early life, you said, was not an easy life. And we're going to talk a bit about that. And I thought a way to introduce it, forgive the dramatics of this, but I think it gets us right in it. You talk about a beating that you had early on in your childhood from your mother. And you say, "I do not remember the physical injuries, but her blazing eyes and uncontrollable rage were dreadful. The nightmare of those blazing eyes would return to haunt me when I was in prison years later, and I had nightmares that my mother was peering enraged through the eye in the door, the peephole through which the guards screamed at us when during their inspections." Close quote. That is a powerful and disturbing link from your early life and your prison life, and it is certainly true that your mother was far more than that later in your life and helping you leave the jail.
But identifications are so vital during this time. And in addition to your mother, you have others. You had your father, you had your father's uncle, you had Janet, your lover at the time, you had your very strong Jewish identity. Start us off. Tell us about your early years and your political activities, and we'll talk a bit about your torture experience.
Well, thank you for your introduction. It's much, much appreciated, as is your sensitivity and your own sense of dignity about the occasion and my own curious history. I'm the oldest of four children. We were raised by parents who were good at many things, but at being parents, they weren't especially good. And we led unpredictable and sometimes troubled lives. We were never separated by our own shared sense of a stand against injustice of any kind that we came across. And that was a bond of adherence and common loyalty. It's the bond that raised me, and it's the bond I've passed on to my own children. And we're proud of the stand we took against apartheid, as indeed I'm proud now of the work I do as a psychotherapist, and I'm very proud of my daughter's own emotional and psychological inheritance from me. She's now a family therapist and an associate professor of family therapy at a distinguished university, taking a lead role in rehabilitation services for the mentally ill and especially for adolescents in inpatient treatment. That's what she did her PhD on, her clinical doctorate, I beg your pardon. And there's a sense of grit, determination, and a certain oppositional stance that we share. So that whilst I had these nightmares about my mother's rage when I was struggling, I also had the assurance that they would be doing all they could to safeguard my life and to do what they could to protect me whilst I was in prison. And indeed, they played a vital part in extricating me from the clutches of the South African security police. I don't think at that point in time anybody had been prized out of their hands alive. And this was an achievement I owe entirely to my parents, which is why my memoir is dedicated to them, as indeed it is. It's dedicated to all those who passed through the gates of the Compol building, the interrogation center, Pretoria prison, and all the other places of confinement during apartheid's years in South Africa. We were raised as Jews, and as Jews, we settled outside South Africa in a small British protectorate called Swaziland. Its name today is Eswatini. It's been much in the news because it's ruled by a monarch. It's not even a constitutional monarch. It's an old-fashioned dictatorial tyrant. And there's been a series of uprisings against him, which have been dealt with in summary and vicious terms. Now, we hear about what's going on in Bielorussia, for example, or in Syria, but we don't hear that much about Swaziland, Eswatini. It's tiny by comparison. It's a population today of only 3 million people. In my day, it was just under 400,000 people, of whom only 10,000 were whites. Most of the whites had their children at the school I attended with my two brothers. We were the only Jews in the school, and we were a curiosity. The kids teased us. I've got a very long, strange name, and I've got a notably Jewish appearance with a big nose and a swarthy appearance. And we were mocked, teased, and goaded. And I learned to challenge the people who offended us and insulted us. And I learned to protect my younger brothers. That sense of mutuality has never left me. And we, the four of us, my two brothers and my sister and myself, and our children and grandchildren are all closely linked in a common bond of confident and assured mutual affection and regard. That was cemented during my brief period in prison. But it was a catastrophe for the younger ones in our family. I was a kind of parental child and had been playing a role helping to safeguard my younger of my two brothers and my sister through uncertain times. And then suddenly I was in prison, and just as dramatically, I was out of the country. It was all deeply unsettling. And amongst the points that bring the most loathsome memories to mind I have about the people who tortured me is a retained picture described in my memoir of the security police major, a man named Tuonis Swanepoel. I think it's always important to name such people. He's long dead, but his consequences are imprinted in South Africa's life and history, much like the character of Mengele or Torquemada is imprinted in the cultural history of Jewish people. Swanepoel was effectively a mass murderer as well as a police torturer. He led the interrogation I went through, in which I spent 5 days standing on a brick, prevented from sleeping by having my head immersed in a basin, and being interrogated round the clock by a team of highly trained interrogators, six people working in pairs of two. So two would interrogate me for 4 hours. They would then be released by another two, and then another two, and then the cycle would start again. That went on from the day of my arrest, Friday the 13th of June, 1969, until the following Wednesday, when I was taken to Pretoria, a local prison. We called it the Hanging Jail, and put into a cell where I spent the next 50 days. Swanepoel led the interrogation. He was also responsible for a series of interviews with myself, my parents, and in due course, the Israeli Consul General to South Africa, who acted as an intermediary and secured and negotiated my release to Israel. And on the day of my release, I was collected from prison early in the morning, taken straight to the airport, given half an hour to say goodbye to my family, and then handed over by Swanepoel to the Israeli Consul General like a parcel and put on the plane.
Let me interrupt you for just a moment, because there's a powerful, there are a number of powerful stories that you're referring to. And the first is the brick. The brick is a character in the book, as it turned out to be a character in your life. And I first learned of the brick in the important and powerful foreword to the book. Albie Sachs wrote a foreword, a very detailed foreword about his experience, your experience, and the experience of South Africa. There may be many here in the States who do not know who Albie Sachs is. He was also a freedom fighter. He was the object of an assassination attempt that came very close to succeeding. And he later became one of the writers of the new constitution and became a judge in the Constitutional Court. He is a dear colleague and friend of yours. Is that a fair characterization?
It's a fair characterization, and he is indeed all of those things and more.
I imagined. But in the foreword to the book, he makes reference to this brick. And I was scratching my head when I read, and I said, so what's the deal with the brick? I mean, I made up all kinds of imaginings, but I didn't know about what the brick was. until I read the following sentence that you wrote. And it was, I stood on the brick around the clock with breaks for meals and toilet as a team of six men working in pairs settled down to interrogate me in four-hour shifts. I talked to them in an open voice, but in another inner voice, I talked to the brick without revealing it. And the brick and I continued the ordeal together. The brick and I became well acquainted, and I would talk to it under my breath, especially in the early hours when my reserves were at their lowest. Later you say, when I got back onto the brick, I sang silently to it. Hello, darkness, my old friend. I've come to talk with you again. The brick and I got even closer that night as I began to sing to it under my breath. I was reminded, as many may be, when I first read that, of the Tom Hanks movie, Castaway, when Tom Hanks develops a relationship with Wilson, the volleyball. And I might add that when this first occurred to me, the juxtaposition of the two, I was a little hesitant to mention it to you because, again, this fragility that I imagined, I obviously one is a fictional character on a movie set, and one is a life-sustaining, inanimate aspect of your torture experience. And I was concerned that you might feel it diminished it. And of course, as the listener can well know by now, there's an ease in speaking with you. And you smiled when I brought it up and you said, oh, yes, you've seen the movie and you thought it does a very good job of representing the metaphor. But it does do a very good job, at least as it seems to me, that the brick became a comrade, the holder of goodness for you, and also somebody with whom you engaged in song. And music, you write, was vital to you during your imprisonment. Simon and Garfunkel in particular, The Sounds of Silence. There's also a story about the night songs you heard that I'll ask you to share. And later I learned, among the many things I learned later of the song Senzenia, which became sort of an anthem for the freedom fighters that I'll ask you to describe as well. But I did want the brick to get its proper billing as being an important piece of your experience.
Well, thank you for introducing us to the brick, or introducing the brick to your listeners.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yes, it was a red South African face brick. I can even tell you its proportions and tell you something about its granular surface, because when I was taken to Pretoria and I kept saying to the people who'd arrested me, I want to see a lawyer, they would reply, yes, of course you'll see a lawyer as soon as you get to Pretoria. Now, I was arrested under a piece of legislation that denied the detainee any right or access to the law or to a lawyer. It actually suspended the judicial process in favor of the Chief Commissioner of Police, who was the sole arbiter of the whole process. When I got to Pretoria, I was led into an interrogation anteroom where there were a whole lot of people poring over my possessions that had been seized from my home, where they'd ransacked the place. And in charge of them all was this man, Tunis Swanepoel. Now, he was notorious already in my day, but I hadn't been following the press about him, so I didn't exactly know who he was. He looked dreadful. He was a very frightening presence, like a monster. And I said to him, I'd like to see a lawyer, please. And he took this as a provocation, and he became enraged, all in Afrikaans. And then I committed the next folly as far as he was concerned, because I said to him, excuse me, sir, but if you want me to answer your questions, would you kindly speak to me in English? I don't understand a word you're saying. Well, this was like giving blood to a shark. He went for me. And they forced me into this tiny little interrogation room off the big anteroom, a whole mob of policemen shouting and screaming. And I thought I would perish there. I thought I was going to die there and then, which is exactly what they wanted me to think. Their intention was to overwhelm me with terror, and they did. But then Swanepoel's interrogation partner, a man named Richter, Harvey Richter, produced this brick. And he held it up in front of me and right across my eyes. And I thought, looking at its granular surface, that it would abrade my face when he hit me with it. But he didn't. He put it down in front of me and said, "Stand on it." Now, I'd never been told to stand on a brick, and I didn't know what on earth to do. So they all went for me, and they beat me until I got onto the brick. And then I was doing what they'd demanded of me. And the brick and I, as you've appropriately picked up from the book, got well acquainted over a period of time. I learned to speak to the brick for the first time the following morning, early Saturday morning. So I'd been on the brick overnight. I'd then been allowed to get off the brick to go and go to the toilet and then sit down at the interrogation desk where they brought me some breakfast. And I was then brought before a doctor. My family had managed to get news to the South African Ministry of Justice via the British ambassador that I was in their hands. I had a British passport because I came from Swaziland, although I was born in South Africa. And I knew that my family knew that I was in police hands when this man Swanepoel said, "We're going to have you seen by a doctor. We understand you've not been well." I was recovering from infectious hepatitis A. And they got a doctor to come and see me. The doctor gave me a close examination, not knowing that I understood Afrikaans fluently. He turned to Swanepoel and in Afrikaans said to him, "There's nothing wrong with this boy. They called me the little Jew, die klein Joodjie. It's an offensive designation in Afrikaans, the little Jew boy. There's nothing wrong with him. Ride him as hard as you like." Now, I understood what that meant in Afrikaans. And when I came back into the little interrogation room and Swanepoel yelled at me to get back onto the brick, that's when I first started speaking to the brick under my voice to say, "Don't be too hard on my feet. You know, it was hurting standing on this brick. And I'll promise not to stand on you fiercely." So I made a sympathetic alliance with the brick, as if to say I could recruit the brick to be kind to my feet by offering to be kind to the brick. And that kind of bond of sympathy stood against what was going on between me and the police. And it lasted. It lasted until the brick disappeared from consciousness. And quite honestly, I don't know at what stage, on days 4 or 5, the brick disappeared altogether.
As I mentioned, you had other points of identification. You describe, at long last, being allowed a visit by your mother and father, and it's a quite powerful moment where it turns out your mother and father worked together to put on a little theatrical event where your mother came in as the concerned mother about her son's health, and your father came in as the stiff ramrod military man. He was a courageous soldier in World War II. And my reaction, again, it's my reaction, was that you might feel put off by your father's stiff bearing. That was not your reaction. Your reaction was to feel proud of his speaking your inquisitor's languages of militarism. And you were right in that that was Swanepoel's experience. He was proud of your father and to that degree proud of you for being related to him. But your father's bearing and his history in the war, and also the history of his uncle, speaking of courageous soldiers. Can you tell us a bit about both of those?
Yes, of course. So, when I saw my parents in Swanepoel's office, I was brought in. They were already sitting in his office. And my mother gave me a big hug and we embraced. I was expecting the same from my father. You know, under other circumstances, I would have had the same big hug from him. Mm-hmm. But he held out his big right arm. He was a good deal taller than me and a very strong He had a very strong presence. And he held out his right hand and shook mine as if, you know, we were in a hand wrestling match. And I kind of smiled to myself, and I heard him say to Swanepoel, without any words at all, "What are you doing messing with my son? And who are you, this puffed up policeman who won medals in peacetime, to be affronting us in this way?" Now, that was all passing between us on unspoken terms. And much later down the line, a month later, by which time I'd really been brought to a quite appalling state, my mother was allowed another visit on her own. She found I couldn't speak. I'd lost the capacity for diction. All those weeks in solitary confinement after the interrogation. And she was allowed to take me to a little restaurant around the corner, and with three security police in surveillance, to try, just by having ordinary conversation, to equip me to speak once more. It worked. I was restored by that visit. And when I was then taken away to prison, Swanepoel turned to my mother and said to her, "Was your husband a military man?" And she said, yes, he was a frontline soldier in World War II, and described his military service. "Well," he said, "yes, I thought he was a proud military man." And that had some impact on this dreadful policeman. And we called on the sort of double act that my parents were playing as part of an unspoken strategy to negotiate terms with them. I was arrested as part of a much wider sweep by these security police. This man Swanepoel was in charge of the operation between May and June. Through those 2 months, the police conducted a dragnet operation throughout the country and arrested every black, coloured or Indian intellectual who looked like they might be oppositional. The underground movement of the African National Congress and of the Pan-African Congress had in both cases been crushed by the events in which the Rivonia trial had taken place and Mandela and the others sent to Robben Island for a lifetime of imprisonment. That was just 5 years earlier. And in that period, South Africa was completely under the control of these very police who were running the show. So they weren't actually looking for anything obvious or visible, and they didn't have any leads. They were conducting an operation at the behest of the Prime Minister, Forster, in the way that investigations were conducted in Eastern Europe during the communist era, when the security forces would arrest people indiscriminately, put a certain number of them on trial, use another group as witnesses, and kill another group because they were inconvenient. And this is how it went. I was one of only two whites brought in through this whole process. The other white became a state witness and gave evidence in the trial that took place 6 months later. I was not part of anything in which they could secure evidence from me. I had nothing evidential, and I had nothing to offer them. It was a case of a blunder, and it cost them. My uncle at the time was the mayor of Johannesburg. I had two other uncles who were leading barristers in criminal and commercial law in Johannesburg. There was a big outcry. I also had a British passport, and there were questions raised in the House of Commons about British subjects held in South African detention. It was a huge embarrassment to the police, and they wanted to get rid of me. They had two options. The one was to kill me and say, "Look, this man hanged himself," or "he jumped down a flight of stairs, broke his neck," because most certainly he was a communist and he was trying to protect his friends from the disclosures he was going to be forced to make. The other option was to find a negotiated way in which to release me. And my parents approached the Israeli consul general, who was in turn approached by the police, and he negotiated my release 55 days late after my detention. But it was a release that came at a price because it cost me my home. I could never go back. It tore our family apart. And it left me stranded in an alien country, unprepared and with no resources. Nevertheless, I did, when I got to London 6 months later, make connections with the liberation movements base that had their headquarters in London. It's one of the reasons I came to London. And I gave them a full account of what I'd been put through. And I was introduced to a leading journalist in London, a South African journalist, who helped me put a full account of my own interrogation into the British press to supplement the efforts being made to cast into doubt the trial then taking place in which the others were being accused of subversion. The lawyers defending those on trial insisted that all the evidence used against them was secured under torture and therefore not admissible. And when I put my article forward in The Observer at the end of August in 1970, it strengthened the case. And in fact, at that point, still, it changed sometime later, the judiciary in South Africa were not in the pockets of the apartheid system to the same degree they were later. And on two different occasions, the same judge ruled that the cases against the other co-accused should be set aside, that the evidence against them was inadmissible.
John, let me back up a little bit and focus on your experience. You made it sound as if it was sort of an easy release, an easy transition, and of course it was anything but that. You were in danger of being killed, either by the security forces or to, as you say, to seduce you into killing yourself. There are stories that I would recommend to those reading the book of razor blades left in bathrooms, which were a not too gentle reminder of that possibility. Tell us about the night songs. Music, as I said, was a vital theme throughout your 55 days, and you would hear regularly the night songs and found solace in the depth and the beauty of them, only to discover Duchère.
Yes, of course. Well, I was put into a cell, which at the time I didn't know, was in close proximity to the gallows. South Africa at that time was executing a higher proportion of its own citizens through a process of judicial murder, really, than any other country. And these hangings were taking place on a daily basis, of course, not on the weekends, because the hangman needed his Saturday and Sunday for recreation. And anyway, this was a God-fearing country, and you didn't hang people on a Sunday. But Monday to Friday, the gallows were busy, and my cell was not far away. I didn't know this when I was put there. And for my first day and a half in the cell, I was completely asleep. It took me a long time to come round. I was rendered psychotic by the days of sleep deprivation and was comatose. You know, I was completely out of it for a good length of time. So I went into the cell at midday on a Wednesday, and I slept until Thursday evening, and woke to find I'd soiled myself. I didn't really know where I was. I couldn't make sense of anything. And a whole series of meals had been piled up beside the little felt mattress I was sleeping on. So these meals had been brought in on a circuit to meet the prison meal requirements. They'd all been piled up there. And It was already getting dark. The sun sets early in the wintertime in Pretoria. And so it must have been half past 4 or 5 o'clock, night coming on. And I heard music in the distance, and it was profoundly consoling. I couldn't make the words out, so I didn't know in exactly which African language they were singing, but I thought they were singing in the language that's prevalent in what's called the Highveld, the Johannesburg area. It's now called Gauteng. And the people there, the prevailing language is Soto and Tswana. They're related languages. I wasn't wrong. They were singing in Tswana, but they weren't singing out of anything joyful. These were men in the condemned cells, and it's not clear. At any one time, there could be several hundred people in these condemned cells, each awaiting execution with hearings to circumvent the death penalty, lawyers bringing cases to court, judges returning the cases. It's like this in the USA in a number of places. And the inhumanity of it has left me just extraordinarily amazed at the judicial system in the USA that has these death rows in different places. Anyway, there I was, close to death row, and listening to the music of the night. I fell asleep to this music, was woken by prison noises early in the morning to hear it again, and then it stopped. What I didn't know was that it had stopped because they were busy executing people. The singing would stop. The whole wing of the prison in which I was would go into silence for about half an hour. And then all the prison noises would start up again. A prison is a terribly noisy place. Banging, clattering, doors opening, slamming, keys rattling, chains. It would all start again. It went on like this every day.
And it was some time before you realized what the songs were about. It was a long period, you write, where it was of warm consolation to hear this deeply moving music coming from outside of you, only to discover that it was something other than just consoling for you.
Well, it was a startling discovery. I'd been there about a week and was taken out of my cell twice each day, once to go to the shower and once to walk around the internal courtyard of the prison for exercise. And usually it was the same warder. One particular morning, the cell door was opened by a much younger warder, a man who looked even younger than me. I was only 21 at the time. And this man looked as if he was only just out of school. He hadn't even started shaving yet. I could see that on his face. Mm. But he was wearing this big peaked prison cap. The prison service all wore these very military uniforms. And he took me out of my cell to go to the shower, and walking down the long corridor all the way to the shower at the other end, I could see that he'd been crying, and he was still wiping his eyes and nose. And I said to him in Afrikaans, "Sir, is anything the matter?" And I didn't appreciate that I have a manner that encourages people to want to speak to me. And he said, no, it's just my job. It's what I have to do. And then I said, well, what is your job? What is it you have to do? And he said, well, the Kaffir that we hanged this morning was even younger than me. And normally it doesn't upset me, but this was just a boy. And then there were more tears. And then I said, so who is it that's singing at night? And he said, in Afrikaans, this is all in Afrikaans, those are the condemned men. They sing at night to comfort those who are going to be hanged in the morning. That's when I learned where I was and what was going on.
Let me be a bit abrupt and shift our attention. Much of your life has taken place in the UK. You arrived there from Israel, essentially penniless, with family responsibilities, and you had to struggle. You had to struggle to make a place for yourself, to make a living, to support those in your care. And you did all that. You became a teacher. You discovered more about this ability you have, that people feel open in speaking with you. And you trained to be a therapist. You write in your epilogue that you've had long analyses, and you've risen in your field. You wrote a major textbook in 2016, From the Couch to the Group, Group Analytic Psychotherapy in Practice, and are a teacher and writer about group analytic treatment, though you, in addition, do individual treatment. Your treatment has been focused for some period of time on those who were victims of trauma, but again, not only that. Tell us about your professional life, your training, what your clinical work is like. I know you've been involved with organizations devoted to helping political victims, but also not that. So give us a feel for what happened after you started your life in the UK.
Yeah, certainly, Harvey. In fact, I left school to become a doctor. I went straight to medical school when I finished my secondary school. But I was unsettled twice over. First, I won a scholarship to go to the USA for a year on a program called American Field Service. And it was an awakening for me. It was a year of enlightenment. I was in Westchester County at a secondary school, repeating the last year of high school amongst American peers during the most bitter time of the Vietnam War, just when Hanoi was being bombed. And my school community gave an award to Dean Rusk, who was then Secretary of State. Half the school community were in the hall to give him the award, and the other half were outside with protest banners against the Vietnam War, and I was with the people outside. So I came back to South Africa and awakened by the political exposure to the youth movement, the civil rights movement, and the anti-Vietnam protest lobby, and carried on with that in South Africa. But I lost my place at medical school and then re-enrolled to do a degree in psychology, which I was only halfway through when I was arrested. In the UK, I was generously supported by a scholarship program that the Scandinavian countries, Denmark, Sweden, and Norway, put together called the International Universities Exchange Program to support the education of anti-apartheid activists like myself. And that covered my fees and gave me a maintenance grant for some years. But I finished my degree. I did very well with the degree. The grant came to an end, and I had to get a job as best I could as a school teacher to support us all. We then had a baby, and I had a younger brother and sister to care for. Worked as a school teacher, then as a social worker, and when I could afford to, I started what we called the group analytic training. The Institute of Group Analysis in London is a psychoanalytic training institute with a public profile and a commitment to social responsibility. And I was attracted to its outlook. The leading figure who established this model of psychotherapy named Fuchs, his name was Fuchs in Germany, was a German Jewish psychiatrist and psychoanalyst who came from the same stable as Erich Fromm, Adorno, Horkheimer, Marcuse. And they had been close associates in Frankfurt until the Nazi ascendancy in 1933 when they scattered. Fuchs came to London, established a training institute, trained a whole generation of colleagues, and I come into the third generation in this succession. The book I've written, From the Couch to the Circle, is a study of the group analytic model. It gives its history, its outlook, its applications, and describes its cousins, the modern analytic movement, New York, the interpersonal model of group psychotherapy espoused by Irving Yalom and Molin Lege, and a number of other closely related models in North America. I've departed from the main professional line that many of my colleagues in this work have followed by embarking on a major human rights enterprise. Not long after I qualified, I linked up with a human rights practitioner, a woman named Helen Bamba. She passed away some 6 years ago, sadly, in her late 80s. And together we established an organization we called the Medical Foundation. It's now known as Freedom from Torture, and it's a major human rights charity in the UK that provides rehabilitation and recovery prospects to survivors of organized violence and torture. And our reach, as we established it in the late 1980s, was to admit all who'd undergone adverse experience of this kind. So we were non-discriminating as to people's points of political allegiance, and we were often struggling to ensure that people from opposing sides of the same conflict, say in Iran, were respectfully treated in quarantine from one another. So I've been working in this way with a double life, really, with my one foot in the middle class world of suburban and urban stability amongst the worried well and the traumatized with developmental problems and borderline disorders, and with my other foot amongst the refugees and really the wretched of the earth.
Let me ask you about this clinical work. It's you obviously bring a special experience and special expertise. With those who have been traumatized through political violence, can you paint a picture of what kind of work you are involved with them? How, for example, you describe working in two different venues, two different frames. How is that different for you as a clinician? Just for example, the obvious thing is the role of self-revelation. Is it different for you with those, you call it, not higher functioning, but non-traumatized patients who come to you, at least not you know, that kind of trauma, and those who've been tortured, use a broad brush. How many of your patients in each category know of your past, and in what way is it useful for you to share it and to use it, and how it fleshes out in the work with each group?
Well, I call on it all the time. The level of disclosure is limited in both cases. I don't find it necessarily fruitful to say that much about myself in either camp, really. Mm-hmm. In the world in which I teach, supervise, and publish, my patients are in many cases trainees themselves, psychiatrists, psychologists, social workers, clergy, and they read my material. So they include many people who logged on to watch my virtual book launch. I make no secret of my history, mm-hmm. but I don't bring it to their treatment in an open or declared way. In the other world, the world made up of refugees and survivors, I'm at home in that world, and I would not normally lead with anything very direct about myself. The people I would be disposed to share this history with more likely would be my colleagues working in this field. But there too, it's not a necessary part of my own process of providing mentorship or supervision or direction. We set the organization up, the Medical Foundation now, the Freedom from Torture. I helped Helen Bamba design the clinical program, and I based what we designed on what had helped me with my own recovery. And we constructed programs of individual, group, and couples therapy. We recruited examining doctors to provide evidential detail through physical examination. We secured the participation of physiotherapists and dance and movement therapists. We created a multidisciplinary team, and I played a part in helping to supervise some aspects of this over a period of some 25 years. I'm not directly involved today in the management of these organizations, but I'm recruited sometimes to provide teaching or supervision, and this memoir is now available to the people who staff this organization. The best point of access I could give is to describe one of our very first clients at Freedom from Torture, an Iranian man who I've called in my memoir, Mustafa, who was one of five children to an Iranian cleric, who came not far from Tehran. He belonged to an Islamic branch opposed to the Ayatollah. When the Revolutionary Guards took control of the country in 1979, they killed many of those who were theologically opposed to them, but they couldn't touch this man because he was of such standing. So they went for his children. They arrested one, they traumatized another. Another was had his head beaten in at a funeral for a previous member of the family who had been killed. And my client was held in a very grim prison. It's notoriety is all over the world, Evin prison in Tehran. And he was put in a punishment cell on the top of this prison where there was no roof. So there was no shelter from the sun in summer or from the snow and rain in the winter. And at some key point during his own therapy with me, he described how there was an elderly peasant with him there who'd been arrested on a whim for no evidence. There was nothing to warrant his arrest. But he was indignant, and he kept on upbraiding the guards to say, you must release me, and they kept beating him. And he one day went to this old man and said, old man, you can't fight in the back here. Keep your mouth closed for your own protection and look after yourself. And whilst you're here, I'm going to teach you to read and write, and that will be our victory against them. It's that principle of turning captivity into triumph through small adjustments of endeavor that I learned for myself whilst in prison. I kept a hidden diary written on toilet paper with a pen I'd hidden on my person during interrogation. And I took this pen with me into solitary confinement. And I had a little Bible, and I would tear off sheets of toilet paper, put them on the Bible, and write a little diary every day. In due course, the guards looking through the peephole must have seen me writing, and they came and took the toilet roll paper off my little pen, but they left me the pen, and I thought, well, they want me to write so they can steal the next load of paper. But I kept writing nevertheless, and it was my salvation, really. I wrote a diary into the flyleaf of my Bible. That's reproduced in my memoir.
Yes.
And I wrote many poems into the flyleaf of the Bible, one of which is also reproduced in my memoir. And I've learned to pass that kind of survival strategy onto others without actually telling them exactly where I've come from myself. In certain cases, it's been helpful to disclose, but in most cases, not so. The same man, Mustafa, came to see us soon after he arrived in the UK. he'd been held in this terrible prison for some period of time, was then released, and an older brother of his was then, many years later, getting married in London. He was allowed out to come for the wedding. And whilst he was here, their father, the man the Revolutionary Guard wanted to destroy, he died of a heart attack. And my future-to-be client became traumatized all over again. It's amongst the things that happen to people who've been exposed to gross trauma of this kind. Successive life events of an adverse kind can often bring trauma to the surface all over again. And his brother brought him to us. He couldn't speak. He couldn't narrate in any sequential way. He'd lost the capacity for diction. He was in a state of complex PTSD. Now, I can remember being in exactly that state myself. I sat with him week after week with his brother as our interpreter. And as we talked, his English came on. And we spent 18 months in a program of individual rehabilitation. He saw a psychiatrist. He saw a physiotherapist. He had a lot of other rehabilitative work. And then I put it to him that we'd gone as far as our organization could afford with his individual work, and I'd like him to join one of our groups. Now, in our last meeting before he moved on to the group, he said to me by way of thank you, that yours is the hand of humanity that has reached out to save me from drowning in my sorrow. And it's that reach that I've learned to continue extending to others. This man went on to do the same. He became one of our trustees. He then went on to run a very interesting business with his older brother. And he and his now wife have three grown-up children. This all took place 30 years ago now. But the stories go on, and there are many other such stories.
Yes, there are. Is this the man you recounted with whom you had an exchange about your Jewishness?
No, this is that's a different Iranian. Shall I tell you about the
Yes, the sure.
Yeah. So this is the case of another Iranian I saw many years later. It's a related story. In this particular man's case, he came to us with terrible headaches and a very bewildering presentation, clinical presentation. I was working closely with the neurologist because, in fact, injury to the head, face, and neck amongst survivors of torture is the most widespread form of lasting damage. And this man had a presentation that our neurologist couldn't get a clear picture of. There were lots of tests, and eventually we put his narrative together with his presentation. He was doing his military service in the Iranian army. There'd been a break-in to a military depot and weapons had been stolen. And because he came from a different Islamic branch, it was believed that he was culpable, which he wasn't. In order to torture him, a team was put together, and four guards each took one of his limbs, and they rammed him head first, like on a, you know, he was like a swing.
Mm-hmm.
And his head was the ramrod, and they bashed his head into the wall again and again. And what they produced was traumatically induced epilepsy. He had terrible head pain. He would have occasional convulsions, but they weren't following any set neurological line. And the most acute problem was that he had ulcerated stomach caused by having too much medication for pain reduction. It was a complex and troublesome story. And it took several years of closely focused work to get him physically as well as he could be, and to help his health and outlook. And at that point, the British government thought it was time he should be returned to Iran. They could see no reason for his asylum application, and I was trying to document this appalling history for an appeal hearing in the Immigration Appeals Tribunal. And I got him to come and see me at my house because it was an urgent case, and I couldn't get to the center to do the final document. It was a hot summer's day, and he was sitting in my office with me as we went through the report. And I am a practicing Jew. I go to synagogue once or twice a week, and I keep around my neck a Star of David, a Magen David, which fell out of the chain it was on. I had an open-necked shirt. Now, he knew nothing about my own history, and he didn't know that I was Jewish. And he saw the star fall out of my shirt, and he grabbed it. He was sitting very close to me to read the report. And he pulled on it, and he said, "What is this? Are you an Israeli? Who are you?" And he was shocked, so shocked that he almost attacked me. And I had to say to him, "Calm down, calm down, calm down." And then I told him more about who I was and what I do. And then he said, "Why should our enemy be helping me?" And I said, "I'm not your enemy." And he said, "But I'm your enemy." And I said, "Not anymore, you aren't. We're together in this." And then he wanted to know why he was told that Israel wanted to kill all the Muslims in the world. And I had to explain to him that that's not the case. It's more truthful the other way around. And then I got off the Israeli subject and explained to him that not all Jews are Israelis, and that the Jewish faith I subscribe to is one in which we do the kind of work we do not despite our Jewish faith, but because of it. And I live under obligation to heal those I can reach. And I explained to him that he would find a similar outlook even amongst many Israelis, which he found it very hard to accept. But there are many other such stories, and I don't want to overwhelm your listeners with the detail of many such narratives.
It would not be, I can assure you, overwhelming. I had the pleasure of carefully reading your book, and I do want to correct the name of your first book because it's an important work on its own. It's From the Couch to the Circle, Group Analytic Psychotherapy and Practice. But this memoir is called When They Came for Me, The Hidden Diary of an Apartheid Prisoner. And the stories you've just related and more go back to my early hesitancy when anticipating speaking with you. And I paused and wondered what it would be like. And you accurately characterize yourself as you're a man who's easy to speak with, and you're a man who's easy to listen to. And I don't know where in you that derives, but it is a place of great grace. And it has been a pleasure to read your work and for you and I to spend time together learning of your history, learning of your devotion, learning of all these identifications inside you, your past, your present, your family. I recommend for those listening in the show notes, we're going to put the book launch where we get to meet your family. John, it's a privilege and a pleasure. It's a privilege to learn from you, and it's a pleasure to know you. You have something special to offer, and I'm grateful to have received it. Thank you for sharing this with us.
Harvey, thank you very much for finding me and for listening and for giving me this platform and for your own dignity and touching way of bringing these things together. It's much appreciated.
All my best.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, We can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.